Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today, Tuesday, November 15, we have Victor Adir and Ira Harris. Both Victor and Ira are legendary industry veterans in investing.
Oh, you're so kind.
Victor started trading penny mining stocks in 1970 when in university. He's worked in the mining sector and also started a gold silver bullion trading company. In 1977, he became a commodities broker and later a stockbroker. He's worked over 40 years in the capital markets industry, and he maintains a trading desk website at victoradair.ca. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years as well. He has also worked at the CME as director there from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. He maintains a blog at iragharris.com. Welcome, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd begin with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets. Victor?
Well, let's say we had a tremendous run in the stock market from 2009 until January of this year. During the course of that run, I think there was a whole generation of people that kind of thought that the only thing stocks could do was go up. A lot of positions were built on leverage. And I think there's been a reassessment of that here this year. Stocks have generally traded lower. Some of the high flying stuff has, you know, just been smashed. And in the decline that we've had over the past, I guess it's 10 months or so, we've also had some really terrific bear market rallies in the stock market. We had, you know, the yield on the 10-year treasury, I think, got down a half of 1% in August of 2020. And here in the last, well, let's call it a year or so since the Fed switched from transitory to, oh my God, you know, we've had a hell of a run up in interest rates. So that's been kind of punishing for people that were over levered. And, you know, we'll see where we go from here. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of drama and excitement ahead. So I'm never going to hang up my skates when it comes to trading and paying attention to these markets I've traded for years.
Interesting. Great. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, you know, Rich, I've had the, you know, honor and pleasure of being on with you quite a bit. So I've kind of laid those out. We did a lot of work the previous week because it's almost 2 weeks that we did the Rosenberg book bar Harris, which was good. And then last week with Brent Johnson. So we can just, I think, you know, listeners of you probably know my view. So in order to expedite and save a little time, I'll just jump into where you're going to direct these questions to.
Sure. Yeah. Victor, if you'd like to delve more deeper into like the interest rate, bond markets, yield curves, what are your thoughts on that and how it connects with central bank monetary policy?
Okay. Now I'm going to talk as a trader. I'm not an economist, you know. I've been a trader when I trade, I guess I'm looking at market action. I certainly spend hours a day reading, listening to podcasts. I've subscribed to a whole lot of stuff. So I kind of get a sense of as to where, let's say, you know, the market is at. One of the services that I talk to a lot, like once a month, I guess, the past couple of years, I've been just every month we've done an interview, I've been bullish on the US dollar. And my training way back when in the Conti days, in the very early 1980s, I was a currency analyst for the firm. And one of the bad habits, I guess, I got into back there was that I thought that I'd be able to understand things, you know, and that's really a handicap for a trader because you're likely to believe that you know what's going on. And my son worked with me for a number of years, and I used to say to him, you know something, there are people all over the world that are trading in the same markets we're trading in. We don't know who they are. We don't know how much they know. We don't know how much they're capitalized. We don't know any idea what their trading time horizon is. And my point is that, you know, we might have an opinion on the market and buy something and it might go up and we might think we were right for all the wrong reasons. So that's just, you know, as a trader, I mean, I've read thousands of reports by economists and God bless them. Most of the time they're wrong. And you know, I don't say that that's to slam them. I don't mean that at all. I never want to slag anybody. It's just that you can't know. I mean, it's almost inevitable that you're going to have some position and or some idea as to what you think is probably going to happen. And by the way, that should not be have anything to do with what you think should happen. Okay, there's what you think should happen and what you think probably will happen. So I'll form a loose notion about what I think should happen, and then I'll look to see if there's trading opportunities around that. So I'm very sensitive to positioning. I mean, if an idea is really popular, let's say everybody thinks that a market's going up, the last thing I want to do is be a buyer. You know, certainly if that idea has been around for a while, I'm constantly looking for an opportunity to fade that. My wife told me one time, Victor, it's just in your nature to call bullshit. You know, you're a contrarian. And yeah. So another thing that'll go with this and then I'll stop is I've met a few people in my career that did really well with trading. And they are as different as chalk and cheese. And by that, I mean, the guys that did really well found a way to participate in the markets that suited them, as opposed to, you know, following the book or whatever. So I guess that's how I approach markets. I thought the US dollar was going to be strong. The last couple of months, I know I started to wobble on that, but I'll give you this and then I will stop. For years and years, I've thought about currencies this way. Capital comes to America for safety and opportunity. And when the world is worried, you know, the US dollar gets bit. And there's also incredible opportunity in America in terms of free markets, all kinds of ideas, like in the dot-com boom, the US dollar had a tremendous rally as people wanted to invest in America. And then on the other side of it, when the attitude is really, really risk on and people are willing to invest money in a country you couldn't find on a map, you know, the U.S. dollar is weakening. So I guess that's kind of why I thought the U.S. dollar was going to outperform, along with the fact that the monetary policy here, particularly once the Fed got off of being transitory, we just had much stronger monetary policy, much more hawkish here than in other places in the world. And that added an additional magnet to capital to come to America.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I've been talking about the dollar was, I understand everything that Victor said, and there's much to that, and rightfully so. But the dollar was rallying. It was easy to see because of course, the rate differential. I mean, Europe is stuck in a terrible situation, and they're always following. I didn't think the Japanese would pursue this yield curve control. I thought it was a bad idea when they put it in place. I happened to be on with Rick Santelli when we talked about it when they put it in place, that it was going to wind up causing some trouble. But a yen that week is a little dangerous for the world anyway. But, and I offer up this spot, and I'm sure this will spike the conversation. The dollar was going to go up. It was a matter of how much it was going to go up relative to everything else. And the danger was, and Victor's old enough to have, as we've talked about, to live through the Volcker period. And I was writing a lot of blogs about it. I said, I don't fight markets. I don't fight markets. I look at them, I go, dollar's going up? Great. I got all kinds of plays I can make because there's all kinds of currencies are always a relationship play anyway. So within the dollar going up, I could find a million things to do. Well, whether it's buying maybe pesos and selling, there's things that I can do. So it doesn't bother me at all, but I'm looking, unlike Victor, I need to know because it's just the way that I've been trained and I was brought to this business, is I have to have comfortable to understanding the underlying fundamentals. If I understand the underlying fundamentals, then it allows me to see the market action. Wow, it really agrees with me. We got a really good play going on here. Or why isn't the market doing this? I've been analyzing these fundamentals and the market is going the other way. And it's a good friend of mine in the 80s who would talk to me all the time about market currency fundamentals. He says, God, you really know a lot. But he raised a very important point to me. His name was Mort Levy. I don't know if you remember the Levy brothers. They were, his brother, Morty, was the best currency arbitrager on the floor. They were the originals. So, but Mort was a brilliant trader. And Mort said to me, your work is so good, but when you've done all the analysis and the market is going the other way, you got to go with it. You got to go that way because it's telling you something. There's a great story. He says, every time we talk, I do great because you lay it out. I go, yeah, that's a real good analysis, but the market's going the other way. I know it's going to be a big. So I've never been able to do that. And my mentor and partner said to him, we were sitting at the table having coffee together in the break room. He says, Mort, you don't understand. He works too hard to put together the concept that if he did it and he faded himself and it went that way, you'd have to go get him off the ledge because, you know, and so, but it does keep me, you know, a lot of people don't understand this, but you do, Victor, that it's not always what you make, it's what you preserve. So if I don't see the markets supporting the fundamental view that, I'm willing to sit there on my hands and do nothing and wait for the market to tell me. That's why I use technicals. Technicals will direct me to when, oh, the market's now telling me that I'm right. I now have, and I can define my loss. That's what I care most about. Keeping my losses small and being able to define them. Because I'll do the work. Right now I'm doing the work. So when we go to the, we're talking about the dollar now. So the dollar is going up and I understand the United States is much more aggressive. And more importantly, because of the Fed's policies over the last 12 years, the amount of dollar funding, which is not usual. Usually dollar funding and carry currencies are different. The dollar is not usually a carry currency. We've not seen that much, but the dollar is a carry currency. So there's so many people short dollars, meaning they've borrowed so heavily in dollars around the world. They're running huge dollar. And this is what really confronts the world now. Now, I've been talking about this for quite a while, but we've gotten a 6%, 7% correction in the last 8 or 9 trading days. Since Richard, I think we did the book of our Rosenberg, because David and I disagreed on it because David was really still bull. I go, I think you have to be very careful here because what's going on with those positions, and I compare it, interestingly, Larry Summers wrote a piece too. I compared it to what the Swiss did in 2015 when everybody was borrowed in Swiss because there was a Euro-Swiss peg. Interest rates were 2% lower in Switzerland. I mean, I just read an article they were writing about it. Oh, the Polish banks are still battling this issue because of all the debt that was priced in that. So that's, to me, what's going on. So all those people who got killed being who had borrowed Swiss franc mortgages, and then they owed Swiss francs, which appreciated, I was afraid is happening in the world. And I think that there is a lot of that going on. The dollar is not a trade vehicle per se. It's a trade vehicle if that's how you earn your capital. But for the world, it's a finance. People finance in dollars. So short, if you've borrowed in dollars, you're short dollars. And as the dollar has been going up dramatically, some people have been getting hurt. Well, I don't think we understand how bad the pain has been yet. And the Fed has taken a view on it. But all of a sudden, on Sunday night, Yellen from Bali was talking about, well, we understand that, you know, that there's some financial considerations. So I the dollar is good. It's not, to me, it's just not that good because I think, you know, of course, Powell's trying to recapture the Fed's credibility to the standard it needs to be. But the Fed did a lot to undermine that. And I would caution that what tells me that that's right is because unlike 2018, when we got the real positive yields on overnight money, which we did, this time we're not going, I don't think we're going to go, we're going to get there. Powell wants to get there. And the gold is $400 or $500 still higher than it was in the last in the third and fourth quarter of 2018. And I think that's a very important tell. I'm watching that very carefully. The gold did hold at that 1630 to 40 area, and we've had a nice pop here. Tomorrow you might get a huge correction because we're running the retail sales number, but all these are in play. So I agree with Victor on a lot. The dollar has been the right play, but I think that people are starting to, I saw gold. I'm nervous about my analysis because Goldman came out the other day and said that they were, or JP Morgan said they were switching their position. I go, maybe I gotta go, no, but I'm not a contrarian. Interesting what you said, Victor. I don't trade as a contrarian ever, but I've always seen the world. It's the way I am. I'm a fourth boy in line. I'm always outside the box looking in, trying to understand it. So I'm not a gadfly to be a gadfly, but I always want to seek and understand it. The tagline to my blog is 2 + 2 = 5 is a beautiful thing. That's it. You know, it's from Dostoevsky. That resonates with me.
What are your thoughts, Victor, in terms of the U.S. dollar strengthening or weakening relative to major currencies and the precious metals? What are your thoughts, short, medium term?
Let's start with really short term. I mean, just here, what was it, last week, we had the Swiss franc rallied about 8% in 4 or 5 days. And I was just giggling here while Ira was talking about people in Europe, places like in Hungary, they'd be taking out a mortgage on their house in Swiss francs. And then the Swiss franc went through the roof on them. And it was like, oh my God. The most important thing to me with my trading is managing risk. And what I keep saying, and I believe this in my heart, I do not make money as a trader because I got a better crystal ball than anybody else. I make money because I'm just brutal about keeping my losses small. If I buy something today and it's not in the green by the end of the day, I'm struggling to stay with the position. Now, that brings up timing. You know, my time frame is usually pretty short. And like I used to be what I'd call a swing trader. To me, that was a few days to a few weeks. These days, when you can have the Dow Jones move 1,000 points in 15 minutes like we did on the CPI number, it's like, wow, you know, you just can't stand in front of that. And then even in terms of standing in front of it, before the number comes out, I'm watching the depth of market on my screen and everybody's backed away. And you know, as soon as the number prints, the algos are going to run that thing a couple of hundred points in either direction within minutes. So how do you put a stop in there? And so it's like, you know, no wonder the liquidity is getting thin, and liquidity and volatility just kind of feed off of each other. I mean, I'm talking in terms of, you know, how I behave as a trader. I can imagine the dollar getting stronger from here. I can imagine the dollar getting weaker. There's guys out there that are a whole lot smarter than me that'll stake out a position one way or the other. I'm probably, push come to shove, but probably think that the sell-off on the dollar here has gone too far too fast. That's kind of how I would think about where it would go. In terms of the short term and the medium term, I mean, I think sometimes if you're, for me, if I was to talk about where I think a market is going to be 6 months from now, it's almost like that's useless information. You know, that's just like something you get if you've had three beers with the boys at the bar, you know, at the sign of the trader there, remember at the board of trade?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember much, but I remember the sign of the trader.
Yeah, I mean, what a place. Everybody's smoking and their beer's going everywhere. And that's where, you know, that kind of talk comes. All right, guys, everybody knows what's going to happen. I think when you're in the pit, you know, if you've been there for a while, and I never was in the pit as a trader, I would go down to the floor, and I've been on the floors in Chicago maybe 50 times in my life. And I was always the only guy on the floor wearing a business suit. Everybody else has got on a trading jacket. And I know they're looking at me like, hey, who's the new pigeon? You know? Ira, over to you.
No. It's and you know what? I craft a view. I always have to, because that's my comfort zone. Because then if I say, well, yeah, I see this and this, and now if it's not happening, let me think about it. 6 months, but as they say, you know, as the saying goes, some days are a decade and some decades are a day. With algos, we see movement. So I'm with you. I mean, I like to, algos don't care about underlying fundamentals.
Right.
They care about the last number and the number and the 100 after that and 100 before. That's all they care about. And they will drive markets to places. So I learned this is a good, you know, we used to want to, especially as a floor trader, the curse of a floor trader is you always have to be in. You wean yourself off of that. I mean, I've been off the floor for many, many, many years, probably heavily off the floor. I would go fill orders just because I loved the energy of the floor. So even when I was managing funds and I could, because I would always do my work and have a game plan laid out. I still do that. I still manage to have a pretty big view. I do so much studying and reading and I have a big view, but I don't let the view tie me up in knots. In fact, again, a lot of times it'll keep me out of trouble because I don't see the market have, or I'm going to give it. So in today's world, Victor, I do things I never would have dreamed of. I put in wish orders that are so far away from the market. You can't believe how many days in a week I can get filled on things. I go take a walk, I go work out, and all of a sudden I go, what? Because I don't carry a trading machine with me because I have nobody to call anyway. Where I used to have three people working at a desk and who would execute and do stuff for me, I don't have that anymore. It's all electronic. I'm sitting here, I could show you the screen. I got a CQG monitor up here with 180 variables. I could show you right now. I'm not.
There it is.
Trust me, it's there. So that's what I sit and look at. And again, there's nobody else. Sorry, I got to get rid of this. Come on. I mean, it's just a different world and I'm willing to be patient. And if I miss it, okay. You're going to get so many opportunities in the course of a day. It's scary. It's scary.
You know, Ira, I've been using CQG for 30 years. And it used to be the reason you went to CQG is because they're the only guys that had clean data.
Yeah.
And if you want to look at a chart and the data's all screwed up, the chart's useless. In terms of risk management, one of the other things I really look at is concentration. And let me also preface this by saying, I trade chicken shit size. Okay. I am not the big swinging dick.
No, you know? Me too.
And I'm still here after all these years. A lot of the guys that were the big swinging dicks, they're history. Yeah. Anyway, for me, risk management is just whether or not, if I got an opinion about a market and I like the way it looks, I take a position. But before I even put the trade on, I know where I'm out if the market doesn't do what I want it to do. I am a macro tourist in terms of, I used to say, you can picture a guy in the soybean pit. He's trading beans, but he's looking over his shoulder to see what's happening in currency. He's looking over his other shoulder to see what's going on in the interest rate market. He's looking across the room to see what's happening in gold. I interviewed Jimmy Rogers a long time ago for this very popular radio show we had here. And Jimmy said to me at one point, Victor, how could you trade wheat in Chicago if you don't know what the price of iron ore is in China? And I understood that immediately. That wasn't a freaky notion to me.
Right. No, absolutely. And I have great respect for Jimmy Rogers. There's a chapter in a book that we share Inside the House of Money that Steve Drobny wrote. And it was nice enough because Drobny said I didn't exist. He heard about me, but he didn't believe that anybody could exist on the floor and think in those terms. And I mean, it's, and then he came down to interview me. He says, and he stayed for 3 days because he said, wow, I really can't believe this. How do you exist like this? This was 2005. I said, okay. It's the way that I operate. I have to be comfortable with a view. If I don't have a view, fine. Then I can go down. But I was never a good scalper. I'll tell you, I was the worst scalper in the history of mankind. But when data would come out, when a CPI number would come, CPI wasn't that big, but jobs number or a trade number back in the 80s was huge. My prep work was so big that I really had a good handle on what the market was looking for. So if we got a number away from it and it was only going to be self-corrective, I could stand down there and get an edge to initiate the position that I wanted at an edge. An edge doesn't exist anymore in this world. You know, as they say, you know, in Guys and Dolls, the famous line of Marlon Brando, if a guy comes up to you, and you're the sucker, and you know what? So we're all suckers now. There is no edge. The algos have an edge.
I think there is an edge, but the edge is if you find a way to participate that suits who you are.
Well, yes. That's what's his name? My good friend Nor Beckstrom always, you know, I think that's what's his name? The trading psychologist, Brett Steberger, Steberger would say, find your edge and trade it. Right. There is an edge, but I mean a price edge where you would stand on the floor and all we talked about pandemonium would break loose and prices, and you would get some type of price edge, because that's why people own seats. Doesn't exist anymore. When I try to explain to people, I said, I don't care if you have $100 million, you go to Wall Street, you're plankton. They're going to feed on you one way or another. Oh, you're kidding. I said, evidently you've never really been around enough. It's just a level to the quality of the plankton.
And given your short-term view, Victor, on the U.S. dollar likely going higher in the short term, do you necessarily have a correlated view on equities going lower in that regard?
Well, in terms of correlation, let me say it this way. I'll look at the correlation, for instance, between the Canadian dollar and the S&P 500. The S&P 500 is my barometer for risk on, risk off. And if the S&P is going up, Canadian dollar is probably going up. If the S&P is going up and the U.S. dollar is going down, almost for sure, the Canadian's going up. If you know those two things are happening and the commodity market is bid, you can almost bet your ass that the Canadian dollar is going up. And if it isn't, then you say, oh, what's going on? I wonder why that is. So I'm always looking at correlations. Now, the thing is with correlations, of course, just as soon as you think you got them figured out, then they change. So you got to be prepared for that as well. I was trading gold before I even became a futures broker. I had a company where we would actually sell bars of gold and bars of silver to people. And it was a tough business because, you know, there really wasn't much margin in it. And I'm glad I got out of that and became a futures trader, that's for sure. But I've been around gold for a long time. Ira mentioned gold a few moments ago. What I have noticed here is that the past couple of years, a strong U.S. dollar and real interest rates being just a toxic environment for gold. And now, you know, that seems to be changing. But for the past several months, I mean, since the spike we had in gold to all-time highs when the Russians went into Ukraine, gold's been struggling. And the prices are down. Open interest was down. If I look at the gold ETFs, the bullion ETFs, they've been net sellers for ever since the Russians went in there. So I thought gold was just like really ignored. There was other things to do. So when gold got a bid here last week, it just exploded the upside for $150. And like that's the kind of situation I've just lived for, that a market's just been totally ignored. It's maybe been sold right out. And when it clicks up, I mean, bang, that's so. Pardon me, I think I'm trying to answer your question about correlations, but that was just an example how the gold market caught a bid with the U.S. dollar weakening and in interest rates changing, and the toxicity was gone from that side of the market.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Ira?
But I think that represented the overwhelming long position in dollars. And after, you know, the interesting thing, and I was in a chat, I was in White Waves chat room on that Friday, November 4th. So the Fed meeting was November 2nd, which was an interesting meeting because the statement itself was, as Waller came out and said yesterday, which I thought was very interesting, they knew that the market was going to perceive that as softening to a 50 basis point cut. That's what he said yesterday to Tim Rose. And I said, wow, that's kind of interesting. And then they were going to use the press conference to reverse that, which Powell did. And so you saw the move, right? For a half an hour from 1 o'clock, I'm talking Chicago time, from 1 o'clock Chicago time to basically 1:30, the S&Ps were rallying. I'm a correlation with you. I mean, my whole life of trading has been building my own matrix of correlations. So the algorithms are only doing much faster than I could humanly, what I've been trading my whole life with money flows and watching the relationships. So they reversed that. We saw what happened. First, the gold and the dollar, the currencies rallied, the S&Ps rallied, the bonds rallied. And then everything reverses. Powell got more and more hawkish, right? He said, I'll quote, I control the messages. As I said, he did as Alexander Haig. I'm in control here. And that is my job, to control his message. And we're going higher. Rates are going higher because we are going to keep at it and put on his Volcker hat. So the markets reversed. But by Friday afternoon, the S&Ps had re-rallied. Now, the Fed funds contracts really didn't change at all. They broke off, you know, on Wednesday. And these Fed funds, which I was watching very closely, really didn't move. But the dollar sold off very big from Thursday to Friday. So, and I'm a big weekly close person. So I look at the weekly closes, and the dollar closed lower. This was like the most hawkish we had seen the Fed. Gold closed already $40 or $50 higher and probably $60 off the lows that were made on that Wednesday after Powell turned on the market. So, Victor, I agree with you, but by Friday, something told me something was up. Now, it may truly have been that the market believes that we're going to be by 5% come, you know, December meet by the end of the, not probably not, 4.5 anyway. And but something else is just, I said, this ought not to have happened. There's nothing else good going on in the world. The other banks are not, the ECB is caught. I don't know what they're going to do because the Fed has got two things going, quantitative tightening and raising rates. The ECB cannot go to quantitative tightening. They go to quantitative tightening, Lagarde knows it, and I think she's willing to give, it wouldn't surprise me to see the ECB go a full percentage point because it doesn't matter. German inflation is 8%. What does a 3% deposit rate at the ECB mean? To me, not a whole lot. But if they started following the Fed down the road of quantitative tightening, then she runs into the fragmenting of the European debt markets. That's her nightmare. So you can, and raising rates won't do that, but quantitative tightening will, because it'll change the whole buying structure of what the ECB does to keep the rates in place. So that's a whole different. So I go, why was the dollar selling off? So really, it made me very, and Sunday night I was able to get short the dollar, but because I said something is not right here. And we saw a nice movement last week. Now that doesn't make me a genius. Things were structurally changing and I could not for the life of me. And we did some technical damage. On that Friday afternoon. So weekly closes. And last week we did some more technical damage. And now we're actually, as Victor points out, we've gone a long way here, and I agree with that. And interestingly, the dollar was down 5.5%. The S&Ps were up 5.5%.
Absolutely.
So, those are the core. I know when you started talking about the correlation, I mean, this has been my whole life. Because when you're in the macro world, everything is just a relative trade.
Yeah.
Things are good here. Things are not. Now go find them. And we need a path to them. And you're right. And when the world has what my dear friend Bernard Connolly, I don't know if you know Bernard Connolly, but in the early aughts, he would say, you know, row, row, risk on, risk off. So everybody, you know, and it was easy. But that correlate, I love, and I'm sure Victor does too, when correlations break down. And you start to see the correlations, right? When the correlation of the Canada to the oil breaks down, I know other things are in place. I think the Canada is suffering a little bit. It should be higher, but it can't overcome the intellectual ineptitude of the Trudeau administration. I mean, they just can't get out of their own way. And they should be. They really should be the world's a key place now because of their ability to supply a lot of energy quickly. And they can operate on both coasts so easily. Yeah, you know, it's, you know, I don't know what they're thinking about, but I just smile because I search for those correlations. And when interest rates matter until they don't. And that's when we love to see that breakdown too, because it's so easy to see, well, I can't be short the dollar because the dollar has got 4.5% interest rates versus what Japanese rates are at negative 10 basis points. European rates are, so that's my beginning of the relationships. And then we look for more, but I'm always searching out. I mean, that's the backbone, but the correlations are built on finding relative values. And I look for the strength in anywhere in the world. And then I'll get short to what I perceive to be the weakest and why it's the weakest. So it's a good way to train.
Hey, Richard, if I could just make a point there on correlations. I guess starting maybe about 6 weeks ago, I referred to the U.S. dollar as a dark horse, as a potential dark horse. I said, everybody is waiting for peak hawkishness to be behind us, and that will change things. Or, you know, the hawkish tone will cause something to break. And then we'll get a reversal. I'm going to propose to you that interest rates certainly are important, but the turn may come from the currency markets. And that's, I think, exactly what Ira was saying here, is that, you know, you look at these different markets and, you know, we're always fighting last year's war or whatever, you know, instead of what's ahead of it. And it's never the same. But I just thought that maybe it's going to be this super strong U.S. dollar that will precipitate the turn.
I agree with you. And that's why when I teach classes, and I've taught I've been a guest lecturer at a lot of universities. It's been a great honor. You better, and I know this is what you've said from the beginning, you better be dynamic in your thinking. And when you say, I'm not an economist, I appreciate that. Because there was a political economist up in Canada, a guy by the name of Robert Cox. I don't know if you remember him. So Robert Cox, in fact, I just read a book about him. Again, you have to see these things and you have to be willing to see them. Economists, there's been a battle between the Europeans and the US because US economists want to build models. Models are static because they're great at aggregating data, but they don't tell you really more than that. And you get caught up in them. I need to see what's going on around them to have a real sense of how to trade it. Just aggregating the data does nothing for me. That's why I've been a critic of the Phillips curve for 45 years, maybe more. It was since I've been in graduate school, because it was too static. We traders like Victor and I, we can't afford to be static. You're static and your work is static, you're dead. You're just dead. You know, again, Louis Gavay's great quote, my clients don't pay me to forecast, they pay me to adapt. I'm adapting. And sometimes I may adapt six times in a week because I go, well, this happened, you know, because wars happened. And how is this going to play out? What's going to be the situation? No, I really didn't believe we were going to see a war in Ukraine. I really didn't. So when it did take place, I had to readjust everything that I had prepared for in the way that I saw energy markets, and there were other things, and the dollar. Because again, that now, and the dollar is still, and I think that Victor's point on dollar is higher interest rates work until they don't. And my problem with the dollar is that the cost of the US deficit is now going to become a political discussion. You know, everybody, when interest rates were at zero, everybody, you know, Larry said, everybody was yelling, the cost of, doesn't matter, keep taking on more debt because the cost, we're at 50-year lows of finance, even though the deficit was exploding, the cost of financing but now it's exploding, I would say, arithmetically. And nobody's talking about it yet. But that political fallout from the rising interest on the debt, to me, makes me bearish the dollar. So I'm answering. I think we agree on this because there's something that's going to happen here. And it's the interest expense that is going to throw a monkey wrench into everything that everybody thinks that there's a clear path here. I don't think there's a clear path because you can't, as my friend Kevin McCarthy always says, and he's a great analyst, he would say, not the Speaker of the House, but he would say, we're in trouble when the interest on the deficit is larger than the defense budget, you've gone into a very different world. And we're going to be there soon. This is not something off in the far distant future. And will that tie the Fed hands? I think that's the biggest underlying fundamental as we look out for the next year. Now, that doesn't mean I'm trading off of that. You can't. You may as well lock me up.
Yeah, I think it's almost there, $736 billion.
It's growing.
Almost to the level of the defense.
But I was answering, where does it become dark? There's some, I think, some dangerous areas out there.
And Victor, in terms of equities, like if you look at the period between 1968 to 1982, do you think that could be in store for the equity markets, like basically being devalued in real terms, or, you know, not moving anywhere nominally, but being devalued in real terms, so that, you know, maybe we don't go down to 3,000 on the S&P index, but in real terms, we do. Do you see that type of potential scenario?
I guess looking at the equity markets, if we want to talk that longer term big picture, one of the things I've been puzzled with is passive investing, where people just put money in every month. Then if the market's up, market's down, you know, that they're just so totally different than my approach, but it's a powerful input. And I don't think we've seen those people turn sellers yet. You know, 2021 was a tremendous time for people that were just passively invested in the market, made lots of money. This year, with the 60-40 portfolio having its worst ever year, I suppose, you know, and it doesn't look like retail has thrown in the towel. Maybe, you know, they've got an investment advisor who is telling them, you got to stick it out. You know, you have these drawdowns like this, these little corrections. I'm thinking to myself, holy mackerel, that's more than a correction. I guess I could be really comfortable to think that instead of having a hard down or a hard up market, we could just kind of grind sideways, you know, for the next year or so on equities. You know, there's a lot of things that you kind of, if you're building a scenario, you have to assume a few things. And then if some of your assumptions are incorrect, then your whole model, as Ira would say, is shit, right? And it's not going to work. So I kind of like to take things one at a time and trade on something like that. And so I can be really clear about whether or not it's working. And if it's not working, I just get out. I could picture it could have a big move. What would cause that to happen? I suppose if inflation stays much higher than the 2% level that the central bank wants, which I think is probably likely, then things like an ownership of a business, buying some shares, might be seen as an inflation hedge. So, you know, I could see that giving us some sustained strength in the market. People are talking about how, you know, housing prices spiked and they've come back down because mortgages are higher than they are. But again, if we have a higher level of inflation than what we've been used to for the past 20 years, which I think is more likely the case, then, you know, I don't think you want to be a seller of your house here. And in the same way, you know, maybe you don't want to be a seller of your shares of businesses. So I guess maybe then, if Ira was saying interest rates are perhaps the most important thing, and I certainly think so. I don't think we would have seen the stock market rally for the past 40 years if we hadn't seen the bond market rallying for the past 40 years. Like, they're tied at the hip. So yeah, I'm going to be watching what's going on in interest rates and see how that plays out in other markets, and I'll make my trading decisions from that perspective.
Great. Yeah, interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
You know, very much the same thing, Adam. And so, so to me, when I listen to Victor say that, it's back on that theme of, you know, hard assets. As we, as Dennis Gartman always said, things that, you know, that if you drop them, you know, as we talked about the other day, you know, they hurt your foot. So, yeah, and I think that there's a lot of truth to that, because first of all, if the stock market stays strong as an alternative, and again, if to me, if real yields don't go positive, you know, that's the real, to me, discussion with Volcker, because Volcker took overnight rates to a positive 6-7%. Imagine that. Is this Fed took them to 100 to a positive 90 basis points, as Julian Riggin said, and I think that's right. We got to positive 90 basis points on overnight Fed funds, and Powell's been honest enough of late to cite that's what it is. Are we going to get there? Right now, again, if we had a Taylor rule, rates would be at 7 or 8% long ago, if they would adhere to a Taylor rule for the most part. They're nowhere near that. We're talking about 4%, 4.5%. And they're hoping that things break fast enough, meaning because Powell's whole game is, of course, by his own admittance, is demand destruction through wealth destruction. That's what they're aiming for. So as I say, he doesn't want to be Paul Volcker. He wants to be Andrew Mellon, and he wants to liquidate all the over-leveraged risk in the system. And I say, or as the Aussies would say, good on you, but we're going to find out, because nobody really knows what that means. The amount of leverage that exists in the global financial system is so big. And if you broke it, if Paul Volcker had been Paul Volcker with all that debt load, he would have brought the world to a depression. Paul Volcker could be what Paul Volcker was, and we'd only endure a severe recession. And I don't take that lightly, because that means people losing jobs and a lot of pain. But in today's world, with the amount of liquidation of assets that would take place, we'd be back to the 30s. And this country, you know, Santelli and I have for years privately and publicly argued, you can't go to 20-25% unemployment. That's a non-starter. I think you got to 13 in the US, and the political foundation starts shaking. The 30s were, and that was tough enough to be able to absorb 25% unemployment. You're not going to that. You couldn't endure a Draghi Europe of Greece and the proverbial pigs, you know, Portugal, Spain, and what they endured. I don't think you can endure that in the United States. So everybody can talk, and they hope they get there without having to break that much. Because if you break that much, first of all, then the cost on the debt gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You run into all kinds of problems. So they're hoping, if I'm sitting in that room, they're hoping that there's a 4-4.5% ceiling on Fed funds, which is fine, because especially if you're going to do quantitative tightening. But I think that Powell also, that there's a dissension building within the Fed. I think that's that paragraph that caused everybody so much angst. What they said, this COVID has had me. So it's almost, yeah, it's 2 weeks ago tomorrow. With that paragraph, what has become known as the Brainard paragraph, was a buy-off. And that's what he had to use the press conference to retreat from. But he put that softer paragraph in there, because I think you have four or five real doves on this Fed board who've been quiet. One was speaking up in Canada today, Lisa Cook. Now, the headline that came out, I went and watched her speech. The headlines did not match the speech. But you have Philip Jefferson and Lisa Cook and Brainard and Susan Collins, who's at the Boston Fed. Esther George, who's probably the most genuine hawk of them all, coming out of the school of Tom Honig. She's been a little softer than most, but there's been no dissents. But there has to be. Powell had to buy off some people at the last meeting. So we're going to see how far that they can go. 4.5, Peter Buchbauer's right, that might be right. And they actually could say, well, we're going to stop here, and we'll just let quantitative tightening take its toll. So that wouldn't surprise me.
Great. And just one final question, Victor. You've worked in the mining sector in your career, and tying that in with risk management, Ira mentioned hard assets. If we look at commodities or the mining sector, industrial metals, perhaps, do you factor in other risks that, like, you know, resource nationalism or government nationalism, oil windfall profits tax, the environmentalist zealots, right, that are against the oil and gas sector? Is it better to invest in the commodities, like in the futures, or in businesses and equities of those commodities? Or any thoughts in there?
The first thing that comes to mind is, if you, for instance, had a strong bull market in gold, the share prices of the gold producers are going to go up faster or more than the bullion prices, because of the leverage they have to a rising gold price. There is just such an incredible array of struggles to be a producer of anything these days. You know, we used to talk about country risk. You know, did you want to own a copper mine in, and I'm going to be polite and not name a country, but in any number of countries, and you might find that the people that run the government there want to renegotiate their share now that you have put a lot of capital at risk and got the thing going. I would say, and my son and I used to work together for years, and now we just stay in touch. But I used to say to him, when we're trading copper, what are we trading? Are we trading, like in New York, 25,000 pounds of red metal, or are we trading some sort of a triple hypothecated financial instrument in mainland China? I don't know sometimes what you're trading. And I mean, if you think you're trading, you know, 25,000 pounds of red metal, but actually it's this highly levered hypothecated paper in China, you could get hit with something you certainly weren't expecting. And, you know, that happens. Staying with that, I mean, I'm always suspicious of stories. Here goes the old contrarian again. But, you know, I mean, for I don't know what, better part of a decade, people have been saying, hey, copper, you got to own copper because of the electrification of the world. And, you know, it takes 10 years to get a permit, and there's not enough. There's no big mines been found, and so on and so on and so on. And, you know, and copper hasn't gone up. It might, but, you know, it's a story. And a convincing story. Another story might be on lithium. Well, you know, there's an old, you were quoting Dennis Gartman a few minutes ago, and a lot of things came to mind. Dennis and I had a number of martinis together over the years. Okay. the best cure for high prices is high prices. And I think that's a pretty much a straight lift from Dennis. And I really mean that. You know, you get the price of lithium where they up, and there's lithium everywhere. You know, it'll come at you. So there's country risks for sure. I think one of the aspects of trading commodities was it was a pure play. If you're going to buy shares in a mining company that produce gold or hope to produce gold someday, there's a whole lot of things that could go wrong that have got nothing to do with the price of gold. You know, right. And so I'm probably, I have been a futures trader. I try to trade things that I think I know something about, or I'm at least familiar with. I have never traded any of the cryptocurrencies, and maybe lucky for me, maybe I'll wrap it up with this. If there's nothing to do in the markets that I trade, then I trade all different currencies, interest rate products, equity products, energy products, and precious metals using the futures markets. If there's nothing to do there, I'll just go out and take my dog for a walk. And, you know, there's a rumor going around that the markets are going to be open again next week. And by gosh, I'll probably be able to find an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Great insight, yeah, experience. And your final thoughts, Ira?
I had said nothing. It's exactly right. I like to hear the mining, you know, because I love the mining business. But when I, you know, as I always say, I'll look at it, I'll develop a big global macro picture, and then within that, I may find some companies I like. Like I'm a big fan of Glencore. I guess it's because I want some of the Mark Rich revenge after. I mean, I'm on the wrong side enough of that for, but I have a lot of respect. Eisenglassberg, of course, has stepped away, but big quality company. You know, I look at it and I go, well, yeah, what's the global picture? Do I like what I see? What is developing? Is copper going to be what it is? Yes, I believe that it is, especially with the ESG investments. Who's going to dominate this? And then I'm not a bottom-up picker. I'm just not. I had this discussion with Mario Gabelli. I did a couple with Gary Commit, who I love, Gary Commit. But when he invited me on Wall Street Week a couple of times, and I was on with Gabelli both times, I said, I'm a terrible bottom-up picker. But once I develop a global macro view that I think pans out, and with stocks, I can be far more patient than I can with the futures. So that's just a whole different, that's my investment. One is my living, one is an investment. So when I look at that and I go, yeah, I think that picture is right. I think there's a lot to said for that. I could see what China is doing. I could see the yuan. I see certain currency actions. And then I'll pick companies. My course, the key to me, who's paying down debt? The worst companies I like are those that are aggregating debt, and they're buying up a lot of, they just want, there's just, that's to me, Wall Street nonsense. I try to stay away from that. Unless the story is so friggin' good and I actually know of the management. It's like with Glencore. Ivan Glassberg to me was a really good, you know, yeah, from an ESG standpoint and some of the political stuff that they have to do, but mining is a tough business and you go into a lot of tough places and you have to deal with some very tough people. You want cobalt? 70% of the cobalt resides, as we know it right now, in the Congo. It's not in good places. So yeah, I'm willing to bet on certain businesses that will be better. Food will be food. Again, to me, it's one of the areas where the Canadians have really underperformed because they should be down. They used to be much bigger, I think, in the wheat business. It's not that they're not growing it, but the business itself. I like a lot of Canadian companies, but you know, it's, you got to deal with the Canadian government, but I will develop that big picture view. I used to love the Canadian energy sector. I don't know what the hell I'm just, in fact, I just put up a chart of Sun just to look at the stock I played in so many times. And now, you know, if hydrogen becomes what some people think, I think the Canadians are in a very good position, you know, but develop a view and then go from there. That's what I have to do. That's my comfort zone. I don't start at the bottom. That's not my strength. Again, and as Victor said, yeah, you have an edge. Here's, you know, and that's my edge is development of an overall view of the global macro situation. And right now it's fraught with danger, but a lot of trading opportunities. Right now, I couldn't tell you on an investment, I'd be very cautious, but from a trading there's so many opportunities. It's and growing, by the way, and they're not shrinking; they're growing. As we deglobalize a little bit, the opportunities grow more and more and more. So,
mm-hmm. Great. And how can our listeners, viewers, learn more about your work? I guess is it the website victoradair.ca?
Victor? Yes, victoradair.ca. The CA is for Canada instead of .com. I usually write a piece once a week about whatever I'm doing in the market that week. People have free access to everything on my website. And that's a great place to stay in touch with what I'm doing.
Cool.
I went to it and it's a great, it is a very easy to navigate and easy to use website, and there's a lot there. So yeah, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Has this blog also at iragharris.com.
Yeah. Yeah, and Notes from Underground. So I'll be back to writing. It's not been an easy few months for me. I got some now. Then the COVID came up and hit me. So I have a new respect for this virus. I would kind of brush it off. I ain't brushing it off anymore. So I got hit pretty good with that. But overall, and some other. But I'm writing. I'll be back writing. There's just too much stuff going on. But I'm much more patient. And I'm patient with my thoughts, and I'm patient with my trading. So there is just mega, and in the realm of algorithm, there is just that much more opportunity if you're patient.
Hey, before we wrap up, Richard, I'd like to personally say thank you, Ira. It's been fun talking with you, and Richard, with you as well. Thank you for inviting me to be part of your program.
Richard, this is great, and hopefully we'll do it again. One day we're going to make this interactive, I think. So.
Super.
Great.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.